Okay. Sorry, apologies once again, and apologies on both ends, because I actually have to end a few minutes early today. I'm going to go to a funeral, unfortunately. So, let's cram it in. Sorry about that. It was a lot of technical difficulties. So, we've got three more Thursday mornings to go, today and two more weeks for this term, which means two more weeks for the Bina Raffle. We'll do it on the last day, as we always do at the end of this term. And I'm just going to do a sort of like a mini-series for the next 3 weeks, continuing on from last week, really, because last week we touched on the concept of resilience, if you remember, in the context of vulnerability and all that. And we drew from, we cited an article, I told you, from a booklet that's been put together from different leading experts on the topic of resilience. This is what the booklet looks like. It's from an institute called Wellness Institute in America, a project of JLI. And I thought, even though we touched on it last week, but it's such an important topic, and we once did a full series on resilience a number of years back, but I thought it's such an important topic that it would be good to touch on again. And what I want to do is, drawing from articles in this booklet, just talk about three different resilient perspectives over the 3 weeks. But what I want to do today is just start with a little bit of an introduction. A couple of important things to understand on the topic of resilience. So, first of all, resilience is something we all need, right? Everyone needs resilience, because resilience is something some people have more naturally than others, but we all need it because we all have setbacks. We all have things that, big or small, we all have things in our lives that don't always go the way we planned them, disappointments, loss of expectations, and so on and so forth. Sometimes it's more severe, which requires stronger resilience, but nevertheless, everyone needs some level of resilience. The good news is, apparently, according to the research, is that it can be learned and it can be taught. So even those who don't have natural resilience, it can be learned, it can be picked up. And today in the psychological world, there's actually a lot of programs that are designed to teach resilience. For children, for example, and just even for adults, there's programs of resilience. Okay. So like everything, there's always the tools that we use to apply a certain program or a certain concept. But then it's also worth visiting not just the tools, because the tools are the things you use, but the question is, what inspires the tools, right? What are the foundational principles that inspire wanting to use the tools of resilience? So I just want to spend a few minutes on that introduction. What inspires resilience from a Jewish perspective? Because as we know, from a Jewish point of view, as I said last week, resilience is in our DNA. Resilience is really who we are. We see this collectively, as we said last week, and we can learn it individually. Right? In other words, we don't always have it individually, but we can learn it individually. You cold?
No.
No, you sure? Okay. But in order to learn it individually, besides learning the tools, you also need to pick up and learn and connect to the foundational principles, right? So I saw a beautiful article from someone called Rachel Holzkenner. And she starts with a tragic story. In 1981, apparently in California, there was a child, Jimmy Beveridge or something. And his three brothers, they went hiking in some mountains in California, and their parents had stayed behind just to prepare lunch or whatever. And this little Jimmy, he got lost, and he separated from his other things, and there was a whole search effort. Hundreds of searchers came to search for him. And unfortunately, tragically, it didn't end well. He was found 4 days later, and he passed away. So some of the reason she quotes the story is because in his memory, some members of the search team, like, they developed an educational program designed to teach children to stay safe in the wilderness, right? And what they did was they publicized a simple sort of life-saving principle that went like this. It says, if you are lost, stay put and hug a tree until help revives. Right? That was the thing they taught little children, which I suppose, because I think what happens when people get lost is they try to look and then they get even more lost, right? So I think the idea was, if you get lost, hug a tree and stay put and wait for them. And she uses this little tragic incident as a bit of a symbol, because as a symbolic symbol. Because we know that in the Chumash, right, the Torah tells us that ki adam eitz hasadeh, a person is compared to a tree. And there are many, many things that we learn in terms of the character of the human being and how we grow and how we become stronger and so on and so forth, that we learn from a tree. One is, for example, that a tree needs to stay connected to its life source, right? So a tree or a plant or anything that grows cannot be detached from its life source. And if you detach it from its life source, which is normally not visible, right? It's underground. Its roots, whatever, it can continue to grow. So we know that the commentaries explain that a tree has roots, which are the strongest part of the tree, and it has branches and fruit and so on. So we get taught the following, that the roots of the tree is faith, represents faith, right? Because in our own life experience, faith is not necessarily something that is obvious or that we talk about all day, right? We do things, we function, we produce, we help, we're kind, we do good deeds, whatever the case is. But what inspires us, or what should inspire us, what should be our foundation, is the strong faith. And that's like a tree. The trees, the roots are strong and underneath the ground, but they hold up the tree, right? The branches, the leaves, and so on, that represents the things that we do, who we are, the different parts of our personality. And then the commentaries explain, just to complete the equation, that the fruit represents our ability to inspire others, because that's what a tree does. It produces a fruit, and a fruit is idea to continue on the legacy of the tree, so to speak. From a fruit, other people can derive benefit. There's seeds, you can plant it and grow a new tree, right? Now, one of the things that a tree does, apparently, one of the most admirable traits of a tree, as she quotes in this article, is its resilience. Trees last for a very long time. Strong trees withstand storms, withstand winds, withstand very, very adverse conditions, right? Now, when that happens, branches can fall off, leaves can fall off, fruit can fall off, but the tree remains, essentially, and then reproduces. So what is it about the tree that gives it such resilience? It's its roots, right? The stronger the roots of a tree, the stronger it can withstand storms and winds, right? So that's the concept symbolically of the human being, right? The strong roots of any person is faith. Emunah, we call in Jewish wisdom Emunah. Interestingly, Emunah has another translation. She points out in this article, a very beautiful thing. It has the same etymology as the word omen, which is skill, a skilled worker, right? Because Emunah is not just a state of being. Emunah is a skill. You have to build faith. It's a hard thing to do because faith, by definition, is irrational. That's what faith is, right? Faith is something that we don't necessarily understand. That's the basis of faith. Something that is purely logical to you and obvious to you in a rational way, you don't have to believe in, you just have to understand it. People often confuse that. People say, I only believe in something that I understand. No, then it's not belief. That's, you understand it, so it's obvious. I don't need to believe that the table's in the room. I see it. Right? I don't have to believe a theory that is well-founded in scientific knowledge because it's understand it. It's been proven, it's been tested, whatever the case is, right? And we know it's something we don't understand, necessarily. Now, it's interesting because that's why on a day-to-day basis, we don't often access our roots. We don't always access our faith. I mean, yes, a lot of what we do is obviously inspired by our general faith. But we don't always access that strong faith that we have because we don't need to. Things are going well, right? So sometimes we even forget about our faith because the day goes, the routine works, and things turn out the way they should, right? You know, like that's funny, the famous story, I think we've told it before, about the guy looking for a parking spot in his very, very rushed for a business appointment, and he can't find a parking spot. Must have been in Sydney, I guess, right?
It was easier today.
Sorry?
It was easier today.
Oh, good, good, I'm happy.
It's
funny. Easy. It's actually funny. I'm temporarily staying at my daughter and son-in-law while we're doing renovations, so it's on the beginning of Bellevue Road, and it's a really strange thing. There's always parking there. And I don't know how they built the city. Like, how come on that road there's always parking? Like, it's a very interesting thing. It's one of the perks of living there. But so this guy, you know, he's getting desperate. So he turns to God and he says, you know what, if you find me a parking spot, I'm going to give charity. He rolls around, still not. He says, if you find me a parking spot, I promise you I'll start putting on tefillin. Or I'll do this mitzvah, that mitzvah. And then as he's promising, suddenly this beautiful parking spot appears. And he turns to God and he says, God, don't worry, I found one. Yeah. So, you know, we always talk about this, right? The morning blessings that we make every day is a symbol of not taking things for granted. We bless God for the gift of getting up in the morning, for putting on clothes, for walking, for seeing, and so on, because we're supposed to train, we're supposed to nurture our faith. Because if we nurture our faith when things are going well, then we are able to use it when things, unfortunately, don't go so well. Right? And that's the basis of resilience. The basis of resilience is because if we don't have faith, it's very hard not to be crushed by a setback, especially if it's a significant setback. I don't know actually how people exercise resilience without some level of emunah, because if things are just random and then they happen to you, then it's crushing. But if we have basic faith, which means we accept that things are painful, and that's not a contradiction to faith, they are painful, and when they happen, it's a setback and it's hard, whatever unravels in our life, but we have basic faith in that God has a plan, which sometimes we often don't understand and doesn't seem right and seems painful and seems questionable and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, he knows what he's doing. They were able to start the process of resilience, because otherwise we lose meaning, we lose purpose, right? Now, Elie Wiesel, in some of his writings and some of his interviews actually, he talks about a relationship that he had with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's a very famous relationship where we once spoke about this. From Europe, he was actually his family came from Vizhnitsa Hasidim. It's a sect of a Hasidic group. He went through the war, he came to America, he had sort of lost a bit of that, and he connected with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he had many, many audiences in the early years after the war. Many, many audiences with the Rebbe. And the Rebbe encouraged him to be resilient and to move on and to have faith and so on. And he writes, for example, one of the things that there's letters, it's published letters even now. There are many letters that between him and the Rebbe that haven't yet been published, which he says. But the Rebbe encouraged him to get married, for example. And he protested, he didn't want to get married. And the Rebbe really pushed him that he needs to continue on the legacy and build a Jewish family and so on and so forth. And he writes just a little anecdote. He writes that eventually he did. And he said on the day of his wedding, he received an unbelievable, beautiful bouquet of flowers from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who had remembered that he'd been pushing him to get married. And when eventually he did, he sent him. Anyway, so one of the audiences he had with the Rebbe, and he writes this in his own memoirs, he said to the Rebbe the following. He said, Rebbe, how can we believe in God after Auschwitz? Famous question, right? And it's a question that many people have asked, and obviously not to judge anyone that asked that question, because going through that, it's a legitimate question. But he said that the Rebbe looked at him in silence for a long moment, his hands resting on the table, and then he replied in a soft, barely audible voice, and he said to Elie Wiesel, he said, how can you not believe in God after Auschwitz? That's what he said, right? And he went on to speak of that night as a turning point in his life, right? Now, it doesn't mean he never struggled with it. We once did a whole series in this. He continued to struggle with his faith. Part of his struggle with his faith is, he writes later on, an amazing thing actually, and this is where you see roots are so important, where he was, the way he was brought up. Part of his struggle is that he was never able to get rid of it. There was times in his life he actually wished he could get rid of his faith, and he couldn't. He just couldn't. He couldn't detach from it at the end of the day. But at the same time, it was the faith that inspired him to go on, to speak to other people, to inspire others, to help and to preach to others to make a better world, right? So the first foundation of resilience is faith. And within ourselves, as we know, we've talked about this many times, we have different layers of our soul, and it's that deepest layer, that fifth layer that we always talk about, that's the layer where faith lives. That's where so we all have it intrinsically. Some people are just not aware of it sometimes. But in resilience, we have to dig deep. And as a foundation to the tools of resilience, we have to really dig deep and connect to our intrinsic faith. So that's the first foundational problem, principle, right? The second foundational principle, I think, to resilience is the concept of meaning and values, right? Where we focus on internal living rather than external living, or we focus on soul rather than body. The reason I say this is because it's very hard to have resilience if one lives a life which is totally focused on the outer, on the superficial, on whatever level. Because when we have setbacks in life, it's normally about the external part of our life falling apart. We lose a job. We lose a relationship. Even a tragedy, God forbid, that happens, right? It's things outside of us. Some of those are very important. Some of those are less important. But it's always about the superficial. It's about the body of the world, not the soul so much. And resilience is possible if we believe that there's a meaning and purpose to life. In other words, the going on after loss of something external and superficial is that I've lost the external, but I haven't lost my purpose. I need to recalibrate my purpose. I have to rechannel my purpose, right? Like the story I told you last week about that childless couple who, at the end of the day, at the end of the road, went on to channel their pain. Pain was there, still is there, but channeled it to help thousands and thousands of people. Why? Because at the end of the day, they had tremendous faith, and at the end of the day, they were people of meaning and purpose. And that's why, in that car conversation, remember I told you last week, she, when they were deep in silence, after the doctor had told them that they'd reached the end of the road, she said to her husband, God said no, but we're going to say yes, meaning we're going to find a way to find purpose in this journey, right? I saw in an article by someone, Alana Mizrahi, she writes a very interesting little twist. You know, we've spoken so many times about Moderni, right? And Moderni is the not taking for granted the fact that we get up in the morning, that God gave us back our soul, a fresh soul, and so on. But she just takes a little bit deeper and she says, you know, one of the things we have to thank God in the morning for, not just for being alive, meaning not just for existing, right? It's not just that we woke up physically. But we say, Shehzata bin Nishmati, we say God gave us back our soul. Now, on a superficial level, that just means God gave us back the source of life. But actually, on a deeper level, what it means is we thank God for giving us another day where we can have soul, where we can find meaning. And that soul, every night, is refreshed, we are told, right? It gets refreshed up on high and it gets back, comes back to us pure and fresh so we can start another day. Meaning that we thank God for the opportunity of having another day so that we can find meaning and purpose in that day. And that's a really important thing. So it's those two foundations, I think, that are the basis of resilience on all levels. Faith also including the concept of Ashkacha Pratit, that everything has a plan and things happen for a reason, and God orchestrates everything outside of us that happens, up to us how to respond to it. When I say up to us how to respond to it, it doesn't mean it's always easy. It's sometimes very painful, if it's significant. And it can be very painful and very tragic and take a long time. But at the end of the day, it's still a choice. And it's our choice to respond based on that faith and to respond by finding meaning or channeling the meaning, finding meaning in the pain. So those are the two, I think, foundational principles of resilience. So getting to the tools. So I'm going to just base myself on an article by someone called Kenneth Ginsberg, who's a professor of pediatrics in Pennsylvania, I think, and also the co-founder of programs and resilience programs and so on for parents, for teens and so on. Now, in truth, this article is more about parents, actually. It's about parents instilling resilience in their children, which is a very important thing not done so well today, actually. We don't live in such a resilient world, unfortunately. Because we're very scared of discomfort, and parents do that a lot. They protect their children from any form of discomfort, which is a problem. But so he talks about how to instill resilience in children, but I thought I'm going to share with you the tools of this article, because It's not just about children, it's about instilling resilience in ourselves as well. The principles are not only for children. The principles are how we instill resilience in ourselves as well. So he does say some people are more likely to be resilient in the face of adversity, but resilience is not something you are born with. Instead, it's something that can be built and nurtured as a part of development. So that's the good news, right? So he talks about the seven C's. This is how he structures the article. The seven C's of resilience. So we'll go through them briefly in each one. So the first one is confidence. Right? And I think that's spot on because it's not just, I mean, faith and meaning is the foundation of resilience. But we also have to believe that we have faith. We have to believe that we can do it. We have to believe that we can be resilient, right? Interesting point he makes is that how do we build confidence? So he talks about it in children. I'm going to transfer it to ourselves. But in children, he says, confidence is not gained. In other words, instilling confidence in children to believe in themselves and their own strengths. He says it's not gained from an abundance of unearned praise, right? Rather, it comes from adults authentically noticing effort and nurturing and supporting skills or competence. Right? Now, so it works like this in children, then we'll see how it works with ourselves. So in children, we know we build self-esteem or we build confidence not by false praise, right? That's a big mistake people made in the self-esteem movement, which is why there was a lot of backlash on the self-esteem movement, because in many places, many schools, it actually created monsters rather than good, healthy children, right? Because they sort of never let children fail, and every kid had to get a prize and all this kind of stuff, and that's wrong, right? Yeah,
I can.
Yeah, that's right, right? I do have a problem with the way prize giving is conducted in schools often. That's not because I think people should give prizes for things not deserved. I think it's very hard in the educational system because it's very outcome-based. So we notice, but it's very hard to notice people competing with themselves and people's own effort and progress. That's a difficult thing to do. So I don't know how you do that, but something needs to happen. But so empty praise and, you know, the kid who sort of makes a little bit of progress in their maths and finally gets down to do some maths homework and telling them that they're an Einstein or a genius or something like that, that doesn't help, right? I think I've told you the story with Rabbi Tversky, because he had the right idea about self-esteem, and it was very accurate and very, very well done. And he tells the story about when he once went to visit one of his grandchildren, and the grandchild was learning to play the violin. And he comes over to his grandfather and he says, Zaidi, I'm learning to play the violin. I want to play this song. And he plays him the song on the violin, and as they say in Yiddish, it was chaloshes. It was terrible, right? So he's very true to his principles. He's very into building self-esteem and being lifting people and so on and so forth. He says, what am I going to tell the kid? Like, you're a Mozart. I mean, it was terrible, right? He thinks to himself, what can he tell the child? So he told the child, you know, I recognize that tune. Play it again and I'll sing it with you. The child felt like $1 million. In other words, I'm noticing the effort, right? I'm not telling you something that's not true. I'm noticing the effort. It builds confidence. I'm noticed. I might not be the best, but we celebrate small accomplishments. We celebrate small competencies, right? And that's the way we build confidence. And the truth is, the same thing is true with ourselves. One thing we should not do is celebrate things that aren't true, right? We should be honest with ourselves. We should be brutally honest with ourselves. We should self-assess. At the same time, we shouldn't knock ourselves down. We should celebrate things that are worth celebrating. We should celebrate small components of progress. If we're battling with sometimes and we make a little bit of improvement, we should celebrate that. Celebrate it for what it is. Don't celebrate it as perfection, but celebrate it as, okay, you know, I lost my temper one less time this week. That's an accomplishment. I know I've got a long way to go, but it means I can do it. I'm not perfect. I'm not Mr. Kind, but it's a step, right? So when we notice that in children and in ourselves, we slowly build the awareness of the competencies that we have. And that's very important for resilience. Now again, this is all talking about when things aren't going wrong. Right? It's very important to build the tools of resilience when we don't need to use it, because then they're there when we do need to use it, right? So believing in ourselves, believing in our own competencies, believing that we can make progress, sometimes slow. We have setbacks, okay, but we can make progress. We can have, we do have the competencies to improve ourselves and to be strong. Not perfect, but we acknowledge our own competencies for what they are, and truthfully, that goes a lot of, and we celebrate those successes, those small successes, that goes a long way in building our own confidence, the awareness and the acknowledgement that we actually can take steps to be stronger, and then we build that skill or that tool of confidence to be used when we really need it in times of adversity. The second C is what he calls competence. And the way it works in children is instilling the belief that they have their own competencies and don't need everything to be done for them, right? This is a very important parenting idea that it's not, I mean, when children are very young, we do everything for them, but it's also about letting them make mistakes and letting them do things, and letting them understand that they have their own inner skills, right? So that can't. So I'm just going to share with you something in terms of how we do it with ourselves. Last night we had a Kayemet event for young adults, and I spoke on the topic of trusting your gut, right? We've talked about this before. Engaging with self, engaging with not being dependent always on everyone else, but understanding we have our own, we have what to offer within ourselves, right? And it's a balance because it's not always a good idea, but sometimes it is a good idea. We have to combine that balance. I told a story. I'm not sure if I've shared it with you before, but it's a beautiful story. It's a story with a rabbi / psychologist who lives in the States. I heard him speak once. He's an older man now, but his name is Rabbi Herschel Weinreb. And he told the story himself publicly once. I was in South Africa and there was an event and he was brought as a guest speaker and he told the story. And he told a story about, he was a rabbi, I think, of a shul, and he had a degree in psychology, and he was sort of dabbling a bit in therapy and things like that. And he had a bit of a, I don't know if you can call it a midlife crisis, but he wasn't sure. He like suddenly didn't know where he should be going and direction he should be taking in life and so on. And he was very weighed down by that ambivalence and that by sort of self-doubt and whatever the case is. So he's not from the Chabad group in any way, but he heard that, it was in the early years of the Rebbe's leadership, and he heard that, you know, the Rebbe sometimes has very good insight and he'll try and make an appointment. He lived in Baltimore. So he called the office of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the secretary answered the phone, Rabbi Khadakov. And he said, "Who is this?" So he didn't say his name. He said, "I'm calling from Baltimore. I'd like to seek an appointment. I'd seek advice." He says, So just very basically, he told him that he's at a very big crossroads of his life. He's not sure what to do. He's weighed down by his future, and he thinks he needs to seek counsel. Now, in those days, Rabbi Khadakov he was the senior secretary, the personal secretary of the Rebbe, and often when he needed to get some direction, he put the Rebbe on the line. The Rebbe wouldn't always speak, but he sort of buzzed the office and put the Rebbe on the line. So he buzzed the Rebbe, and he said to the Rebbe, "I've got someone here from Baltimore who is facing a big sort of decision and crossroads in his life, in his career, whatever the case is, and he's seeking an appointment." So the Rebbe said, I mean, the Rebbe had many appointments, but this time the Rebbe answered on the line. He said, "Tell him that in Baltimore there's a very good person, his name is Rabbi Herschel Weinreb, and he should speak to him." Okay, so Rabbi Khadakov goes back and he says, "The Rebbe said that he'd advise that as a first point thing, you should speak to Rabbi Herschel Weinreb." So the goes very silent and he says, "Well, I am Rabbi Herschel Weinreb." So Rabbi Khadakov, as a faithful secretary of the Rebbe, never mixed in his own opinion. He was a conduit. He didn't come in. He goes back to the Rebbe and he says, he answered that he is Rabbi Weinreb. So the Rebbe said in Yiddish, "Oy bazei zol reden zu sich." If that's the case, you speak to himself. And he did, exactly. He did. He tells a story. What does that mean? He understood what the Rebbe obviously somehow knew, that actually he needed to connect with his own inner self a little bit, right? He needed to dig deep within himself. He needed to reconnect to his values. He needed to reconnect to what he wanted, to his focus in life, to his family, whatever the case was, right? And he said he followed the instruction. He did exactly that. He reflected. He spent time thinking, connecting, going deeper within himself, in his consciousness, to understand his own you know, where he came from, I guess, what inspired him to do what he's doing now, what are the reasons, what are his goals. And he came out fine. He's a very successful person, actually. And he said that actually he took this as a sort of an ongoing instruction where often when he has problems in life, he engages with himself, right? Now, I spoke about this last night. I said, obviously, you need to be very careful with this idea, right? Because as we've talked about very, very often, I mean, the Rebbe obviously knew that in this, his case, it would be successful. But the reason that you have to be very careful with this idea is because, as we've spoken about many times, especially if we understand the complexity of the human being Kabbalistically, we know that we have layers of consciousness, the way we think, the way we understand things, the way we do things, and so on. But we also have in our superconscious and our subconscious, we have two opposite forces, right? We have the force of ego and the force of the divine soul, I'm just saying it quickly because we've talked about this many times. And when you consult yourself, you don't always know where it's coming from. You don't always know what's driving you in your own decisions. Because as the Talmud says, Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo, a person is related to themselves. We're biased, we're subjective, we're not objective. And obviously we do need objective perspective. A lot of times we need objective perspective, right? Which is why the Pirkei Avot, why Ethics of the Fathers always tells us, each person should make for themselves a mentor. Each person should acquire a friend, a true friend that they can confide in and trust and get real objectivity from and so on and so forth. So obviously there's a balance between that. But it also means, the reason I'm telling you the story is, and I think this is what he's talking about, competence, that we all have a certain level of competence. So, I mean, the way I take it and the way I always try to do things when I have big decisions is not just to, oh, I've got a big decision, let's consult right away, right? We don't do that because you actually do need to engage with, so you need to think first. Because we have within ourselves a lot of strength. We have a lot of competency. A lot of times, and most times, maybe it's not good just to trust ourselves. And therefore, it's always good to consult, to get an objective opinion, right? I've told you stories of myself when that's happened, and it's been amazing. Like, just one-liner from an objective person has turned everything around. And that's good, and that's important. But it's also important not to be needy and not to be dependent on others. And that's why it's such an important part of resilience, because resilience really is internal. Now, of course, as we'll see later, it needs support, it needs connection, it needs a lot of things from other people. But resilience is best played out when actually it's coming from self and supported by others. It's not coming from others. It really can't come from someone else. It's got to come from within, supported by others. So that's why this understanding of our own competence is the second C of resilience. The third one is connection. So that we know, human connection allows us, right, it allows us to celebrate good times and to be supported in tough times. So, I mean, Brené Brown talks about this a lot. Connection is really the DNA of human experience. And again, it's when resilience doesn't need to be used so much is where we need to strengthen our connection, strengthen our relationships, put work into our relationships. Because again, connection is not something that comes. Connection is something that's worked for, right? To build real deep connections with people is something you need to invest in. It's not something that just happens. Any relationship needs work. Any connection needs work. So we need to examine our relationships. We need to see what kind of relationships they are. They're deeply connected relationships. Do we have connections? Do we have deep connections with other people? And when that's in place, that's always effective and always beneficial, always, even in good times. But it certainly then becomes a very strong support in times where we need resilience. The fourth one he talks about is character. So he says, I'll just read it to you. He says, young people with strong core values make the strongest contributions, have the best sense of self, and have the most secure and healthy relationships. Things of character strengths are those things that ensure that we do the right thing even when no one is watching. Right? We need people who know how to do the right thing. So what does this mean? In other words, what he's saying is that part of the tools of resilience is building our own values, really. What I mean by that is, it's about something we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, right? It's about how we live our life. Is it by external perception? Is it by what other people think? Or is it coming from inside, right? And that's something we've talked about so many times, about the inside-out model or the outside-in model. In other words, how do we live our lives? Does it start from the outside and come inwards? Or does it start from within ourselves, within our own soul, within our own meanings, in our own purpose, our own value system, and so on? And of course, in Judaism, we have our moral compass, the Torah, and so on. But because when we live from the inside, then our being, our definition, our identity is not taken from what happens outside of us. It's taken from who we are. In other words, our identity is not taken not defined by what's happening to us, rather it's defined by who we are. Now, obviously, that's a critical component in the pathway and the journey to resilience, because pain, setbacks, failure, loss of expectation, all of that is about things that happen to us, right? It's not about who we are. It's about what happens to us. When we have a strong sense of identity of who we are from the inside, our character, things that we live by even when no one is looking, things that we do even just do because it's right, the values that we implement because that's our higher purpose in life, then that comes to the rescue when things outside of us, things that happen to us, are difficult. Because even though things that happen to us are difficult, it's who we are that matters. And it's who we are that we can always be no matter what happens to us, right? We spoke about this before. When we have values, those values can be implemented always, even when the things that are happening to us are different now. They create a sense of certainty, they create a sense of strength, right? So that's the fourth one, the character. Next one is also really, really important. You know, when setbacks happen, when failures happen, when tragedy happens even, people often get very sort of instilled with a sense of hopelessness, like you know, I don't count, and like I'm just a victim of things that bad things happen to, whatever the case is, right? So he says the fifth tool of resilience is contribution. Right? Contribution. Understanding that we have purpose and we contribute to a purpose. Now, in Judaism, this is like 101, right? This is like so important. And so important to remember every day, but particularly when like we're not in the mood of doing anything. We've given up, right? That idea that we've spoken about, that when God gave the Ten Commandments, he gave it to 3 million people and to all future souls, but he spoke in the singular. He said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm your God, talking to each individual, right? You matter. Your contribution matters. Every person, yes, we have a uniform moral compass, but we have individual missions. And God doesn't create people or doesn't give people another day if their particular good deed or their particular contribution doesn't count. Which is the meaning, the deeper meaning of the Talmudic expression. We've said this many times, that a person should always say, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, the world was created for me. Which on the surface sounds like a terrible statement, right? And some people take it literally. And they live like the whole world revolves around them, but that's not what it means, right? It means the world depends on me. The world is created for me. My contribution makes a big difference to the world. What I do matters. Not even though what I seem to do, I could do whatever else. I mean, I do the same thing someone else does. But no, the way I do it, my contribution, my individual uniqueness matters. And that's a very helpful tool when we talk about resilience, because the motivation to bounce back is because I matter. My contribution matters. I need to continue to give meaning. If God has kept me alive or God has given me another day, I need to keep working. I need to work through this pain. I need to acknowledge the pain, but work through it and give it meaning and purpose because my contribution matters. In other words, I can't afford just to go under the blanket and say, listen, that's it, I'm done. Because, you know, someone else can take over from here kind of thing. Right? Like I've done my time, I've done my contribution, it's too hard now, it's too overwhelming. I'm crawling under the blanket and enjoying life for the next however long it takes, right? Can't do that because we have a unique contribution to make. So that's that fifth thing called contribution. The sixth one he calls coping. And the way he interprets it, I think he just used the word coping because he needed a C, because it doesn't really fit with the, right? But he talks about the sense of coping mechanisms that people have to make long-term decisions, right? As opposed to quick fix behaviors, right? So the difference between quick fix behaviors and long-term coping mechanisms is that quick fix behaviors just make me feel okay now, but they don't necessarily help me in the long term, right? So the ability, well, he talks about again, the ability of raising children who can think long term and make decisions and understand that every decision we make has a long term effect, right? But it's not just, in other words, not just about telling children what to do on for the now. It's about instilling values and instilling that mechanism to think ahead, right? But I think this is especially true in times where we need resilience for ourselves as well, because when we always focus just quick fix solutions of what I can fix now to make me feel better now, then those decisions when we're going through real pain aren't very effective, and they normally counterproductive, or they don't have good long-term effects. But if we build the mechanism of actually learning how to cope and thinking through something and saying, listen, it's hard today, but the step I take today will put me in good stead for in a few months, and I'll take slowly and one step at a time. So that becomes another important tool in the journey of resilience. And finally, and probably maybe this is the most important one of all, is control. But the control that we always talk about, right? It's a sense of understanding that we control ourselves, right? And in terms of parents, what he says to, he says that, and this is something that's so important and so lacking today, it's about teaching children, young children, that sense of they can control their own impulses and they can control and go against what they naturally want. Right, in order to make real choices. And like he says in education, for example, it's not enough just to tell children to do something because I said you have to do it, which is a good start, but it's also about, you know, delayed gratification and teaching children to overcome their own impulses and how to not jump at something. You know, it's the marshmallow experiment that we talked about many, many times and so on and so forth. And from a Jewish perspective, I mean, that's a fundamental concept. We've talked about this many times, that we have the idea of Bechira. One of the foundations of Jewish learning is that we have free choice and we have control and the need to control. The problem is not to control everyone else, but to control ourselves, right? That concept that we actually can't control anything out of us, but we could control our own reaction, right? And that's why when it comes to resilience, that is critically important, because we have to know that people who are much more in control themselves, when it comes to times where they really need it, it'll be easier for them to demonstrate resilience because they have that control. In other words, they have the control that even if something's uncomfortable, even if something is difficult, they can make choices that will have long-term good effects. So that's the concept. So therefore, when we experience pain and setback and failure, even though we have experienced that, but the belief and the acknowledgement and the inbuilt determination that at the end of the day, I control how I'm going to respond, that is critical to the journey of resilience. So those are seven C's, as he calls them, to the concept of resilience. Just to quickly summarize, so we talked about confidence, of course, that's the first one. Competence, the idea of understanding that we have within ourselves, we don't have to always dependent on others. Connection is, again, critical. Character, values, having our own sort of living from inside, contribution, knowing that we matter, having the ability to make long-term decisions, that's coping, and of course the idea of control. So the bottom line of all of this is that, the good news is that at the end of the day, resilience is a difficult journey and doesn't happen at once, but it can be learned, and at the end of the day it's a choice. So that's the base of the concept of resilience. Next 2 weeks, I'm going to show you different articles, just different perspectives on the concept of resilience, really important ideas. And as I said, we'll do that for the next 2 weeks. Good. You're welcome.